Guitar Insider. Good times here with Brett Williams. What am I doing? It's my birthday week. That's why I'm in a good mood. I'm in a relatively good mood. I'm sitting here dealing with my birthday present from Wendy, which is a Samsung soundbar. And it doesn't work well with my Xbox. So that's the bane of my existence right now. That's like, that's all I think about. You know? It's just amazing what the brain will manufacture for you to get upset about if you have nothing to be upset about. I mean, everything's going relatively well. The snow's been, I like snow, but it's been kind of a pain in the ass as far as getting around. You know, I bike everywhere I go to save money and to stay healthy. And it doesn't work, though. I mean, how is Rupert so skinny and I'm so fat? And he doesn't do any of the stuff I do. He doesn't work out. Saw him the other day. He just looks like looks awesome. Looks like a hipster, you know. The whole thing, I can't get my, I'm doomed to be a little bit bigger all the time. And have people, when I tell them that I work out 3 days a week, which I do, and I work hard. Let me tell you what I do. I go and I do like sit-ups all over the place, like in between doing push-ups, you know, lifting weights. I vary it up, you know. Sometimes I just stay home and do like, you know, cardio tapes. Like once in a while, I'll do like a P90X or something. Every time I go to the gym, I jog for 20 minutes on the treadmill. I mean, what else can I do? And then when I tell people I go to the gym, they go, "You do?" Just like that. There was a girl at Best Buy who, speaking of all this speaker nonsense, there was a girl at Best Buy who I went in there to return an item. Because, see, that's how my mind works. That's the problem. That's like what I'm thinking about doing now, and I shouldn't. I should just leave it alone because it's awesome. And it's a great gift, and all it's going to do is make poor little Wendy feel bad. So I'm going to hold on to it, even though it's an amazing speaker. I'll explain it in a minute. But I was at Best Buy, and this was a couple of years back. This is probably, but I was still working out, still biking to work, still doing things that all the other skinny people don't seem to do. I love their advice on how to, like, my brother's a skinny guy. My little brother, he's like a naturally skinny. He doesn't really gain weight easily. When he thinks he's fat, it's nothing. He does the whole thing with skinny guys where they take their flat stomach and then they scrunch it up in their hands and they show you that there's like extra stuff there. And you're just like, yeah, but it's not visible unless you scrunch it up in your hands. Yeah, and I remember one day he goes, "Well, your problem is breakfast sandwiches." Because 2 or 3 days a week I went to Mike's and got not a bacon, egg, and cheese. I got a ham, egg, and cheese. All right, ham has like 2 grams of fat in it, if anything. And he told me that the Christmas we were in Connecticut, him and I, it was his first Christmas on the East Coast. He was sort of stranded here, and he told me it was when I got diagnosed with dystonia, so it was like 2 years ago or whatever. And I was just pissed all the time, and then he told me that, and I think we got in like a fight. Like a fist fight. Because I was like, I was not having it. I was like, "What? You don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean breakfast? You know, the problem is you eat breakfast sandwiches." And we were drinking and stuff, but it was like a fun fist fight. It was like a little wrestle, and you know, he wanted to cry a little bit afterwards. That whole thing, you know, that happens to us. I don't know if it happens to you and your siblings, but maybe you guys aren't close. Maybe you guys have a lot to talk about. You should probably work your way through that so that you don't die with a lot of regrets. But if you're not in a position to get into a fist fight with your brother, you really haven't experienced the love and joy of brotherhood at its deepest and most profound levels. Okay, so the chick at Best Buy. So she goes, "You work out?" And I go, "Yeah." And she goes, she's checking out. And then she goes, "But you have boobs." And I was like, I started cracking up, and I was like, "You should." I thought it was funny, and I'm not the kind of guy to get mad at, you know, people I don't know. I don't get really that mad at people I don't know. And I said, you know, the people to absorb my wrath are usually Wendy or my family, but people I don't know, it's like I'm the sweetest guy in the world. It's not fair, but I think it's the way most of us operate. We should think about it and make the appropriate changes. But so I kind of let her get away with it, but I was laughing and I wasn't even hurt. I just thought it was hilarious. And I was like, you can't tell a customer that he has, man tits. You can't do that. What's the matter with you? But I just said it really quietly. And I was like, I should totally tell your man. I was like, just let me give you a tip. Don't tell customers, with penises that they have breasts. Okay, I don't know. That's may have gotten a little far for the show. Penis and breasts is not bad words. But, when I was explaining this show to a parent that I trusted, that I thought could listen to the show without going to the, outskirts of the administration to tell them that I'm doing a guitar show with swear words every, 45 minutes. I thought about it and I was like, I'm not really talking about sex or anything like that. Like, it's fine, right? I just put the explicit on there because if a parent does approach the show, they know that it says explicit. And then it's kind of on them, in my opinion. Like, I've done my job. Like, I'm not going to censor myself, but I'm also not going to, I don't want to drop a bomb. Let's sit around and listen to Brett. And then, I'm talking about how I have man breasts. And I say the word penis, or I say the F word once in a while when I'm with a guest, because you know what? We're two adults talking to each other and that's the way it should be. Anyway, what was I talking about? Yeah. So it was my birthday, which was fun. I did Super Brett Day. That is where I combined the Super Bowl with my birthday. I haven't done that in many years, but Wendy had a party and a lot of the same friends would have gone to that. Plus it was our year to host the Super Bowl. And Wendy, for some reason, decided that she just wanted to do her birthday by herself, which we've never done before. But she decided that she wanted to do her own kind of birthday. And she said the reason was is because I'm a pain in the ass when it comes to committing and scheduling to a place. And I am. And she's 100% valid with that. I mean, she cannot get it right when she books a place. And it's not her fault. She's easy to please. And if I go into a place and it's too loud or too crowded, then, my whole birthday's ruined. And, I look at the year through dark glasses. And so she did the right thing. She taught me a lesson. She taught me to be more forgiving of the places because I am not a planner, but I am an excellent judge of whether or not a place meets my expectations. So that's not a good combination. What I need to do is do the plan more. But generally what I do it is I do it at Grassroots, which is this dive bar downtown. That's where I've done the most of them. Not generally, but that's where I've done most of my birthdays. And the reason is because, we've all experienced the situation where your friend picks this place. And especially if you're in New York or, a big city, San Francisco, something like that. When you're going to a birthday dinner, oh, Jesus. Right? It's like you walk out of there $80 to $150 short because you're paying for a plate of garbage that you didn't really care about. And then you're paying for a portion of your friend's garbage. And drinks are completely out of control. What are we going to do about this, fellow drinkers? What are we going to do about the cost of alcohol? It is insane how much I am willing to spend on a beer or God forbid, a drink with liquor in it, and how little I am. I'm sitting there and I'm scouring the appetizers looking for something under $10. But yet, if it's some mezcal or some tequila, I'm sitting there drinking it for $15 without a thought. We've been programmed. It's almost like wedding rings. My dad told me that wedding rings used to not have diamonds on them. And now we're just expected to buy these diamond encrusted throne jewels for women. Anyway. So I always have it at Grassroots so people don't have to experience the pain of losing a small fortune for, a friend who otherwise ignores you. Anyway, so yeah, that was the deal. But so I did that, and so I want to have a lot of friends around because I have a lot of friends. I want to have a lot of friends around, but I want them to be comfortable, and I want them to feel good about being there. So I figured combining Super Bowl and Brett's birthday into a Super Brett was the way to go, right? It was the way to go. It wasn't as much, you know, some people came in, I got to be honest, and some people did not greet me with happy birthday. They said hi to me and hi to everybody else like they were at a Super Bowl party, and that's what I don't like about it. And the reason for this is because when I was 16, I had a birthday. That was, what was it? It was a bad birthday. And I just remember I didn't plan my sweet 16, right? I didn't really plan it well. And my mom asked me what I wanted. And I said, you know, probably a lot of people will come, you know, cause it's my sweet 16. So just someone's going to, you know, lightning will come down from heaven and everybody will know that that's happening without me having to alert them to it. And my mom bought this thing. I think it was called the Fat Eddie's. And it was this pizza that took up the entire dining room table. It was like the size of a little person. It was the size of a child. It was the size of two children laying down next to each other. So the thing is that this pizza was massive. And me and like three other people were there to eat this thing. And it was me, a girl that I liked, Stephanie, and my friend Ty. Ty Ive, who else was there? Mary, and that's it. And then it ended up with us eating too much pizza to have any of the other intoxicants affect us the way that they should. And so we sat there with that odd mixture of teenage intoxication and complete wanna barf full feeling. And it ended up we were all arguing with each other the whole time. So I decided that my birthday from that point on was going to be a big deal. I always planned it. I always made sure that I was surrounded by people I loved because it did hurt and I wanted to feel better the next time around. So, you know, I make sure that I plan it. And all those people that don't plan, all you guys that act like you don't really care, maybe you don't now because we are old. I mean, this is my 37th birthday we're talking about. 37, right? You know, you do, because I always get those last minute things from the guys like, hey, you know, just throwing it out there. But maybe you could, you know, meet me at this really expensive restaurant and pay for me and yourself. And if you got $150 loose and you want to show me that you love me, that's cool. If not, then you probably don't love, you know, like that whole thing that you get the week of and you got to drop everything. So I don't do that to people. First of all, it's inexpensive. It's either at a dive bar or my house. Second of all, it's not going to be crowded. It's not going to be loud so that we can catch up. I like to invite people from Manis, even people I haven't seen for a long time. And I like it to be like a big day where I get to see everybody I love. I mean, really, it's important. And I think men are really bad with relationships. I don't know if I've talked about it on this show a lot, but I've talked about it a lot. And this is an opportunity for me to, you know, just even if you just see somebody once a year at your birthday, it really is enough. It's enough to hold on to a relationship and to hold on to a relationship that's not necessarily professional, but, you know, relationships in general. And so that's what I do. And I want it to be something that was the problem with Superbread, is that not everybody could go to it. I couldn't invite everybody I wanted. And like most parties, it just ends up being, you know, it ends up being shared friends between me and Wendy and then, you know, some of her friends were there that I was sort of like on the fence about, you know, so people that I wouldn't have necessarily invited to the party, you know, if it were my birthday party instead of just a Super Bowl. People that showed up and didn't say happy birthday, Brett, first thing, got a little something from me. You know, I nailed him a little bit. I don't know why that pissed me off. Anyway, what else? So, you know, speaking of friendships and stuff like that, I got a little email from Tony Landman concerning last ep podcast. Where is that one? You guys, okay, listen to what he says. All right, here he goes. Sorry, I'm looking this up. You know, I should have had this all queued up. Anthony Landman. Oh, it's so funny. All right, so check this out. So Anthony Lammon, you know Tony Lammon, the guy who, you know, was on the show, the composer, my friend from Texas, amazing, amazing composer, Anthony Joseph Lammon is what I'm supposed to say, and I'm saying it. All right, he goes, hey man, been listening. First of all, good on you for calling out Romero on bad perform. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I told him I wasn't going to say that first part. Okay, anyway. So he didn't say anything like that. I just made that up. All right, second, maybe I'll edit it out, maybe not. All right, so the second part is, second, I am writing to tell you that I could not disagree with you more about your assertion that rock and roll was not invented here. Remember when I said that? I don't know if I said that last time. I guess I did. I did say that. And then he goes, all artists that you mentioned came from rock's birth. The people who invented rock and roll were, by and large, African Americans. All right, so that's where I missed it. That's where I missed it. All right, I'm going to continue reading. All those artists that you mentioned from the 60s and 70s, and yes, even Pink Floyd, were all playing off that music that originated in the African American community in the 50s and early 60s. People like Little Richard, Ray Charles, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Chuck Berry, these were the pioneers of rock. Yes, these groups that you mentioned brought rock to a whole new level, but rock was not invented by them or any other white European. It was largely co-opted from earlier black artists, even without credit. So I say rock and jazz was invented here, not in Britain. I'm not the one for nationalism, but yeah, we invented it. So fuck you, Brett. Fuck you and your whole family. That's what he wrote. I think it's just funny. Oh my God, it's true. And he's absolutely right, by the way. I'm completely wrong. And this is a good thing about people. Like, this is why you should be listening to his podcast and not mine. His podcasts are Anthony Joseph. No. Oh, come on now. Where is it? Okay, I know what his podcasts are. He's got the All the Cool Part. It's called All the Cool Parts. And yeah, go listen to that. The other one I think is called 1,000 Songs You Should Listen To Before You Die. It's based on that book. There's a book that has like 1,000 songs, and he goes through all of them. Maybe it's 10,000 songs. But him and his friends, you know, listen to all of them and analyze them. And you know, it's fun because you get to listen to music that you know, but, you know, in the context of its, in its historical context. Anthony Lammon is one of the smartest, the funniest guys out there, and you should be listening to him, not me. I don't, you know, so go listen to him because he's absolutely right. I have been thinking this thought about that thought about rock, that it was not invented here, for years, and he completely dispelled that thought. But I see, I'm too stupid to think of Ray Charles and even Chuck Berry as rock and roll. Maybe it is like, am I being racist? I just think that it's sort of almost as like an R&B thing. Is that bad? I don't think it's that bad. Anyway, so I know they invented it and we stole it. I know it. Not we, but, you know, Led Zeppelin and stuff, I guess, kind of. See, I kind of see it as more of a combination of those things and other things. But that's just, I know that that's the root of rock and roll. But anyway, he's right. I'm wrong. Right? Am I wrong? I think I'm wrong. Anyway, let's get to sponsors. All right, sponsors. Renato Bellucci makes beautiful guitars. You should go check him out. All right, let's go ahead and check out Mangori.com. He has been on vacation, folks. All right? I'm going to get a hold of him one time at some point. But you go to Mangori.com. You take a look at Renato Bellucci and his beautiful guitars. He's Paraguayan. I'm actually trying to get an interview with Berta Rojas right now, who I think is from Paraguay, and I've got to go, and I've got to interview her. Look, I completely understand people not wanting to come to the apartment, you know, but I really want her interview, so I might go to her. Don't tell anybody, because I don't want to go to anybody ever. And I think it's disarming when they walk into my apartment. So it takes someone who's further along in their career, sort of puts us on an equal playing field. We can have a real discussion as opposed to me just sitting there kissing their ass and interviewing them and having it be all about them. Because it's not all about you. It's about me too. All right, anyway. Go to Mangori.com and check out Renato's beautiful guitars. He is a master luthier. He's on vacation right now enjoying himself. He's taking a picture of his food, the whole thing. I see it on Facebook, okay? Like him on Facebook. Like me on Facebook. Like me on Facebook. I don't even have that kind of a thing. I just have the personal Facebook page for this. Personally, I think the Facebook thing. Anyway. So we're going to move on to omniconcerts.com. We're going to see if they still got their raffle. Why is none of this stuff in my search engine? All right, I'm just going to go omniconcert. Omniscient. All right, I'm not looking for that. What am I looking for? Sorry, guys. Omniconcerts.com. That's got to be it, right? There it is. Okay. Yeah, I don't know why my search, well, my Google bar is not automatically filling in stuff for me. All right, the raffle's still going strong, guys. Enter the raffle right now. Give $20 to the omniconcerts. All right, do it for me. Give them $20, and you have a chance at winning a Hill guitar, a Chord classical guitar case, 2 full series tickets for next year, $100 gift certificate to at GSP, or 10 sets of Diodario classical guitar strings. All right, enter now at omniconcerts.com. Do it up. All right, so I said do it up. That's what Mark Maron says. That's his podcast thing. But I've been saying do it. You guys who've seen my concerts from 10 years ago, I said do it every once in a while. It's more about whatchamacallit. It's more from, what's the movie? There's a movie with Ben Stiller and stuff. He says do it. All right, so what are we talking about? Next concert, Chris Thile. After that, solo duo. Those are your concerts for February. Omniconcerts.com. Go to it. Omni Foundation for the Performing Arts, the Bay Area's go-to source for all classical guitar stuff. All right, check it out. If you want to donate to them, please do. If you want to donate to me, donate to me. If you want to donate to both of us, then that makes you an angel. All right, and I'll say your name on the air if you do that. Eventually, I got to tell you who's on the show, right? Okay, so today my guest is Rene Escuerdo, and his wife is there, Alina Chekin, who's I think I'm saying her name right. She's awesome, though. She's a great guitarist in her own right. She's got to come on the show, too, and tell more stories about growing up in a communist regime. Huh? These two. Different sides of the globe. Same coin. Anyway, so today I'm going to have him on. I'm going to have her on some other time. It was super fun. It was Christmas time, so we referenced Christmas time quite a bit. And there's a lot of banging in the background. I just want you guys to know that I have taken care of that since, I think Badi Assad. I've interviewed Badi Assad recently, and that with her is the first time that I used felt, a big felt, thing on the table to keep the banging from happening. Because no matter, how hard I try, to persuade people not to, hit the table when they're talking. It seems that us guitarists have a real issue with that. And the editing has been a total pain in the ass. So from now on, there should be a lot less thump noise. I tried to get the arms that come up, but they don't really make them for the cheap little microphones that I have. So I'd have to spend like literally $600. And I know a lot of you guitarists love spending money on that kind of garbage. I don't. You know, I've never been a big audiophile in that way. I know that's, counterintuitive when you think about a musician, but, I like to spend my money on stuff that is not guitar related. Anyway, let's get on with the show. One of the finest young guitarists. He's been one of my favorites for a long time. I should have said that in the beginning of the intro, but here's Rene Escuerdo. Oh, you did?
But I went ahead.
What were you doing?
2004.
Was that when you were at Yale then?
No, that was after Yale.
Oh, so you just came in after Yale and had some fun.
I did my New York bit right after Yale graduation. We both did.
Yeah.
She was teaching in Bloomingdale School of Music.
That's
and
sure.
I was part of the New York City Teaching Fellows. Uh-huh. So I was teaching on the public schools. You know, I started doing that because I didn't want to do whatever.
Did you do that with Rami then?
I was the one that got Rami into
that's
that.
That's what I'm thinking. Now he's like doctor teacher.
Yes, yes. I mean, Rami, if you're listening, I didn't know that he was gonna stick to it that long. You know,
because now it's his thing.
Yeah, it's his thing, and well, he's amazing.
He's one of those guys. This. Yeah, he's one of those guys that should be teaching. Yeah, now, I don't know if I necessarily I do it because I have to, but it's not. I'm not. I don't. You know, I see people like Rami, and who are kind of you know, came up in a teaching family. They understand the value of it. Me, I'm just more of the struggling artist that has to teach these kids, whereas he really enjoys it. Like he had
a rough time at the beginning, you know, because
he didn't like
it's not that he didn't like it. It's just
He didn't like the inner city school kids are difficult.
It was not the inner city. It's just the purpose of the teaching fellows is to actually staff the schools that are very hard to staff, first of all.
Yeah.
And second, that they have, like, you know, huge problems getting certified teachers to stay there, you know.
Yeah.
Because as soon as the teachers get certified, they just try to find a better school
that
would take less years of their life.
Right, going
because it's very
going
challenging.
Up north a little bit.
Yeah, anywhere, you know, with pays better, when it's less of a struggle. There's a struggle always, but different kind of struggles.
Yeah, so you did that. I mean, you actually...
I did that for 2 years since, what was it, 02 to 04.
Yeah, so you got your certification and then you left New York State.
Actually, I was in a very challenging school. I mean,
I'm sorry. You mean the school you were teaching?
Right. Yes, and I think after 2 years of that, I pay my dues and I go straight to heaven.
Yeah,
if there's one, because it was very, very, very difficult.
Well, now you work with kids at Wisconsin too.
Yes.
So you're in charge of that whole department, like kind of like the Juilliard prep of Wisconsin.
Uh huh. Exactly.
Now, this isn't Madison. Is this Madison?
No.
Which one
Milwaukee.
Is this?
Milwaukee.
UW-Milwaukee,
okay. Yeah.
How do you like living in Milwaukee?
Cold. But
I mean,
it's
a huge
great
jump from Cuba to,
to New York
to
and
Milwaukee.
To Milwaukee. We never before stopped in the Midwest. We were flying.
Yeah, I never go there. Yeah.
From like West Coast to East Coast.
Right.
We were just jumping the whole big middle in there. And we like it. You know, people are gentler, I should say. They are more patient. Food is great.
I forgot to ask you if you want. Did you want
I'm
coffee?
Good. She may, but I'm okay.
You sure? 100%.
No,
okay. Sorry. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No.
The people are gentler.
Yeah, they are. They are just more patient. They like their speed of their lifestyle.
What about the slowness? I mean, is it a slowness?
Absolutely.
Does it bother you ever?
It did at
like
the beginning.
Taking 15 minutes to get a bagel or something.
It doesn't take that long, but yes, it did get to us at the beginning because, you know, we came from New York and I wanted to do this and this. We need to do that and we need to do this.
On time, all the time.
They were like, ooh, you know, this is the Midwest. Everything takes its time. And they were right, you know. Eventually, I still haven't adapted to that. I'm still pushing my way through it. But
Would you ever run into that problem with the actual students, with your students? You run into students that are sort of like ho-hum?
No.
No, they're all...
Yes.
Yeah, I bet.
That's when they come in, you know, I give them that this is what you're going to do. You're here because you want to do it, and this is what I need from you.
Yeah.
And you let me know what you need from me.
Right.
And we keep all things clear from the very beginning.
What are your students doing at this point? Are they doing a lot of competitions? What are they
I have like several students, actually, that I have one. Ian Toski, he's now a graduate student at Yale. He won the Classical Minds and a couple other ones. I mean, I don't know all the names. They are the ones that find the competitions, and I just get them ready and set them. I have a Vietnamese student that is also doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
In general, from the graduation rate that I've been having in the program, we have a pretty good results overall of teaching positions. And some of them still go to doctoral degrees, some of them to masters, depending on where they come. So
what are your feelings about competitions? Because you did some, but you didn't do all.
You know, I just did the big ones. And, man, I didn't do a GFA, though.
You didn't do GFA? What kept you from doing that?
Scott Tannen.
Really?
Well, Scott, if you're listening, I don't know if I should be saying this. He told
Please
me...
Please say it.
No.
Okay. He's fine. He's fine.
Yeah, I know he's fine. He'll kill me after. He said that I should... I remember, like, I brought him... I was...
Because you did not... You didn't go to school in USC.
No. he came to do a class at Sony Purchase, and I was Ben's assistant at Sony for a year.
Uh-huh.
And I came and picked him up and took him to Sony, and then, you know, we were having a coffee and a bagel in Cozy, I think was the restaurant. And I asked him, I said, do you think I should do this? And he said, you know what, do Tokyo and do like other bigger competitions. But, you know, at that moment in particular, he didn't feel that GFA was something I needed.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, about the rest, he was...
He felt like you could bypass it?
Because you had to ask him that, but yeah. He said that it was not necessary to build a career. Because my concern was like, should I do this? Because, you know, it has all these 50 concerts, that is great. Right. I said, well, you know.
If you win.
Yeah.
And that's the big if. Even if you're you're an incredible guitarist. We all know that. The thing is that if you win, and that's not, you don't necessarily have power over that.
Absolutely none. That's something that you learn. You know.
I've got a friend. I'm 37. I got a friend, Giacomo Levita. I don't know if you know.
Oh, I know Giacomo.
I was in a duo with him. He's been doing the GFA. I never did any competitions.
Yeah.
I just never wanted. I guess I'm cheap. I never wanted to spend the money to go to one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I never had the $600.
Yeah,
to go
to do the investment and stay there. And
you know,
then
get fourth.
Yeah. I know.
You know, I mean, but Giacomo's been, he's been back at it now. And it's been difficult for him, and you know, I mean, because he's made the semis, but now he's not.
But you know, they have.
If you don't win, it's just like
they have been giving the wrong impression
it's a time commitment too. It's 6 months, a year of your life.
They have been. First of all, I mean, the reason why I haven't done as many is because I think that it's a false impression that if you don't have this many amount of competitions on your pocket, you won't be able to have a career. That's absolutely not true.
By studying with Ben too, you get that perspective.
Yeah,
because he didn't go that direction at all.
That generation, none of them, like most of them, didn't do any competitions. You know, if you look at
Scott,
I think Bill Kanagarza won that year that Barrecos was in that second and Sharon got first in Toronto. But it's just they did one or two things to just get a name established, and then they move on.
Really your generation, my generation, that we're the first to feel the pressure of having to do it in order to have a career. Period.
Yeah, because the level of the guitar has risen up in the last 15, 20 years.
Right.
You know, so they're better guitarists, a lot more.
Way more.
So people feel that in order to be noticed, you need to like actually do all this amount of competitions. But there are so many factors that has so very little to do with your actual playing that are involved. You know, yeah, it's true, you know, if you have a great performance stage and, you know, and you're a great performer, chances are you make it. But
a great player.
But it's not just about that anymore. Yeah. And it was never. And you know, I did 3-4, and that was it. And I stopped. I said, like, I don't need to just keep on going.
It's time to start performing.
Exactly. It's time to make a life after performing and let the younger people just take over and just, like, start going to competitions and take their experience.
You're never going to find your voice if people are telling you, do you need to play these three pieces every year?
I have known people that have, like, you know, more than 10 competitions, international competitions, and they don't have a career.
Right.
You know, so it's very debatable. I mean, I'm not saying it's bad, but because what it gives you is exposure. Yeah. You know, you go there and people know you. That if you go with that attitude to a competition, I think you're already winning.
Right.
In that sense, if you think that you need to go there to win, then you know you can be up to for a lot of like disappointment because it's not just up to you or not to the level of your playing. And every year in every competition, it varies so much the level. You know. You can go 1 year in which the level will be very strong, and then another year it will be lesser, and then you have better shot. So, you know, you have all these different levels, you know, and for some reason that I don't understand why they haven't quite done that thing in which they keep the first prize. If nobody played up to the standards that they want, Yeah. That they will keep the first prize deserted. They won't allow it to anyone. They always give a
That's
prize.
An interesting, yeah, idea. Has anybody incorporated that or no?
Well, many competitions around the world do that. They just don't give first prize if they don't find, wow, like the first, you know, the top players that went that year measure up to, like, for example, it's very hard.
I mean, I don't know any American competitions.
And no, they just give everyone first prize.
Because if nobody wins, there's no winner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it's not like everyone gets a trophy type of thing. It's not. But they just don't want to not give it to anyone.
That's great.
I think so too. You know, because then it keeps truly, you know, because if you measure the curve of players that have won first prize in GFA and see, okay, you know.
You have no idea what you're getting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm not going to say anything, but you know, one year it's.
Neither am I.
One year somebody's.
Yeah, very strong. Some others are lesser strong. They are all great players.
Right.
You know, we're talking about taste in many levels as well, you know. But for example, like that year that Marcin Dila won, Pablo Garibay was second place. and Pablo is an amazing player. You know, he just happened to go to the GFA the year that Marcin.
And now he doesn't have. And it's like.
You know. He's playing.
Oh, he's playing. No, he has a great career.
Yeah, he's doing quite well. I mean, we just had him at UWM in December.
Oh, great.
He came to play a concert. And, you know, he's very tasteful, very elegant player. So there are so many good musicians out there. And
well, I think what it's going to come down to is performance, style.
It's when you get on the stage.
How you are with the audience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How you interact and how everything goes.
And I do like the competitions for the fact. I mean, I even like American Idol on TV because I don't watch it, but I like the idea of the next pop princess actually being able to sing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's sort of the same thing with the guitar. I like the idea of the next guitar, you know, whatever, the next guy to be the standard. It's nice, and it makes it more of a meritocracy.
Yeah.
Which I like. But at the same time, if it's not, like you said, it's actually not that way. You come to discover there's all sorts of different variants involved.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not a strict meritocracy. Well, if that's the case, then we need to go back to the concert hall and see who's doing, you know, who's presenting something that's relatable to audiences, who's presenting stuff that educates the audience, and who's presenting stuff that's entertaining. Now, which kind of brings me over to Carlos Rivera and your relationship with him, because Whirler of the Dance is, and I've said it to death on this program, but Whirler of the Dance is probably my favorite.
He would be glad to hear that.
Oh, I know. I've played it. I've taught. Yeah, he. It's my favorite piece of new music. Period.
Carlos.
I just feel like if people were writing more music like that, the landscape of the classical guitar would be very different.
Well, yeah, but
as far as audiences,
yeah. I mean, the whole story with the piece was.
He dedicated it to you.
Yeah, he wrote a piece called Mystica, which is actually a very good one.
I don't know.
He dedicated to Ernesto Tamayo. And for some X or Y reasons, Tamayo didn't get around to perform it and premiere when I was living down in Miami. And Carlos gave it to me and said, like, I want you to come and play it in this June in Buffalo Composers Festival.
Sure.
So I learned it, and I went there and played it, and then he told me, oh, man, thank you. You know,
now, he's in Washington, D.C. at the time?
No, he's in Miami now. He was.
Oh, okay.
He's born and raised.
That's right.
And he was born in Washington, D.C. Carlo, I'm sorry if I'm wrong about this, but like I think he was born in Washington, D.C., and he grew up in Costa Rica?
Something like that.
And then
he came
back. He came back to Miami, and then from Miami.
Did you go to school in Miami, or did you?
You
were teaching there.
I was teaching a little bit, and I was. I did actually try to. I was in FIU for a little bit, Florida International University, and I was in Miami-Dade Community College, just learning English and getting soaked in the system because it's so different. The educational system from Cuba, which is based more on the Russian school.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah, yeah. For sure. You're actually my first Cuban guest.
Oh, is that right?
That's absolutely right.
I'm honored.
No, it's great. Go ahead.
So Carlos, he said, I'm going to write you a piece.
Right.
You know, and I just, he's like, is there anything particular that you want? I said, well, don't kill me. You know, just write something that I can play.
Right. It's very playable.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. And he actually, Carlos can play it through.
the whole thing. He can play it.
Yeah, he can
play it. Well, I know he's like a kind of a rock guitar guy.
Yeah, right? He actually was a very good classical guitarist too. He won. Oh. I think he got third prize in a competition in Connecticut. I don't remember the name of the competition.
Hartford, something like
that. Yeah. And playing the Tres Danzas Concertantes by Brouwer. So he actually could play.
Yeah.
And he sent me a little, was it a tape? Yeah, a tape. With him playing the piece throughout, you know, I loved it immediately. And then he asked me, "Listen, this, you know, they're doing the piece, set piece for the GFA. Can I send it?" I said, "By all means, you know." So he sent it to the GFA the year that Dennis Asavagic won.
Yeah.
And you know, it went really well. He got the ASCAP prize for the piece, and I really loved it. I mean, I love the piece. He started he had the theme for the second movement already. He used some elements of
Stravinsky
play. He's in love with the Stravinsky, it's all over that.
Yeah.
But the second movement theme, he already had used some of that material for a theater play or some sort. And then he built the first and third one around the second movement. So I think the second movement came first.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the case, because those slow movements and those really... Those lush harmonies in that. I mean, you can really feel that that's the heart of the matter when you're playing. And also just, you know, that's where the real, you know, I don't know if you've ever composed, but I have. And the thing is, when you're composing, those are the special, when you're doing the dishes and something comes to you, it's the inspiration.
Yeah.
And you can really hear it in the second movement.
Yeah.
Whereas the third movement is, I mean, it's unreal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much, it's so easy to play. You know, I mean, right hand wise, and at the same time, it's so interesting and it's so complex.
Yeah,
there's so many textures. But the second movement is so. I mean, it's a song.
He always loved Leo Brouwer's music.
So you know, there's so much of that.
There's some of the Black the Cameron, but in their own way, made the
with these like composition. with these Germanic harmonies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's such a good combination. Because it really is. It's Brouwer-esque in its rhythmic textures.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then all of a sudden you get these big, beautiful European melodies.
He keeps writing a lot. I mean, he has had a couple good breakthroughs, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say that now yet, because... He was always interested in doing film music.
Yeah, why not?
He was his passion. You know, once I called him, and I happened to be watching Star Wars on the first episode, and I guess he knows that movie like inside out.
You mean the
out.
First episode of the new?
Of the old.
Oh, okay, so Star
the
Wars.
The original.
Now they call it episode 4.
Episode 4. So I was watching that, and then, you know, I'm talking to him, and he's like, Oh, I know that. You're watching that scene when he's like, and he was even describing every single thing that was happening with...
especially the third movement.
Scene,
the third movement sounds... There's that one little section of it.
Yeah.
There's that one little... There's some sort of a bridge.
Yeah.
There's some sort of modulation. Yeah. And it sounds... It's very Star Wars. It's very like, here comes...
Pretty much.
Here comes the stormtroopers.
Yeah.
I think someone said. Because I was at Texas when that piece was on the... So Steve Kostelnik and Klondike Stedman were all playing
it.
And I was an undergrad. I was a little guy.
Yeah.
I was a, you know, 19, 20-year-old watching them play this piece. But, I think I said that. I was like, it sounds like Star Wars.
Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a little bit of everything. So he always wanted to do... That's why he moved to USC.
Mm-hmm.
But then the few things that he got through... In composing for film, I mean, he didn't like what they were doing because...
Grey's Anatomy and stuff like that I saw.
They were doing just some... Yeah. They would tell him that, I want you to write something very specific like that sounds like Williams or that sounds like this other composer.
Right.
Instead of letting him explore what he would like to do and how we like to do it.
Yeah, so he doesn't like the film industry anymore.
No, he still does, but like he just quit that for the time being, and then he was writing for the...
Because that's a big part of it. I mean, from what I understand, George Lucas asked John Williams to compose a piece that sounded like Gustav Holst and Igor Stravinsky.
At the same time,
so that's just the way it goes.
I know, but still, you know, at some point, that was earlier on William's career, like after that, like William, yeah, like just
let him do what he wants.
Yes, like, this Harry is Potter. The scene.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Right.
You know. So I mean, I think Carlos wanted to have that little bit more of that freedom from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And you know, I think he's coming back now into film, and it's something big that is going to happen soon. That he land a job.
But so, you're not allowed to talk about it.
I cannot tell you.
That's
yet.
Okay. It's okay.
But
it's
he cool. will. But he will come out, and it be huge.
You actually remind. I haven't even thought about having him on the show, but I gotta have him on the show.
You awesome. Should. He actually just called me today when I was coming, like getting here.
Oh, he knows because I recorded Whirler the Dance yeah. too. So yeah, he should know. He might remember.
Yeah, of course.
But so he was calling you today. What are you guys talking about? Just that?
I didn't. I mean, I couldn't pick up the phone call. I just kept on. After this, I'll call him to see. He's probably calling to wish a Merry Christmas.
Or, yeah, right. Are you guys spending Christmas here?
Yes.
Do you guys do Christmas or? Is...
Yeah, we do. Okay, we do.
You like my tree? What do you think?
It's good.
It's so small. Does it smell still?
It does.
A little
you
bit.
You know, it's better than plastic. A lot better, I tell you that.
It was only $20.
Wow.
It's not bad.
No.
Well, up here, great. It's not bad. I mean, down
yeah.
in Milwaukee, that's probably, you guys probably got
a You can get it. No, you still buy them. They grow
tree.
Them. Yeah. I don't have a 25-foot house, but like...
Well, is your house, I mean, you know, is your house kind of big now? Because you live out in the middle of there? Do you get like a
yeah,
big place?
Yeah.
Because you probably lived in a place like this.
Yeah, we have an apartment about the size of this.
Yeah, with I got one bedroom back there.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a one-bedroom apartment in Pinehurst, so it was great. I love the guitar.
But, oh, there's a guitar. Yeah, you know, I get a lot of those. I get a lot of guitar objects, and generally I throw them out.
Well, we but collect them too, you know.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, we have like all kind of guitar stuff related.
Yeah, well, you don't want too much of it.
No.
My mom said she liked penguins one year, and now we have penguin crap everywhere, all over the house. It's gross. So that's your relationship with him. You also have a relationship with Jorge Morel, right?
Yeah, we both do.
I don't know why I did so much. I did a little bit of research on you because I don't do research. I generally don't do research for the show so that I discover things
as you go along.
But I don't know. I wanted to read a little bit about you because I knew about your relationship with Carlos.
The whole thing.
Jorge Morel, though, he wrote you a piece too, huh?
Yeah. Various, actually, pieces. Jorge Morel was teaching at Lehman College when I was doing... the New York City teaching fellows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after going to school teaching, right. I would have to go to Lehman College,
right,
to take and do the evening classes. And then I wondered, like, if there's a guitar professor here. And then they said, oh yeah, it's Jorge Morel, but he doesn't come to school. He just teaches at home.
Right.
So then I just called Elena. Met Morel many years ago, before, in Poland.
Yeah.
So, you know, I called, guess what? Whose roster of like right. teaching here at Lehman College is Jorge Morel. And she's like, oh, we gotta go see him. So I call him and Maestro, how you doing? I'm a student here at Lehman College. Lehman College mostly is for like music education
right.
degree, you know, so they don't really have performance major. So he told like, well, yeah, come over. You know, he was expecting, you know, a guy that just struggles through the instrument a little bit.
Yeah.
And I just went there and did my thing. And he's like,
and he's like, oh,
why are you in Lehman College? Then I told him the story. And he used to live right in Queens.
Someone told me he just moved out.
Yeah.
He's no longer in New York City.
I'll tell you about it now. Forest Hill. He used to live in Forest Hill. And then after that class, then we would go like weekly. You know, we had like these Saturday get-togethers in which we'll just drink and play guitar until like 3 in the morning, and then I will take the train back to Manhattan.
How does he stay up till 3 in the morning at his age?
Oh, he's like so, I mean, he's so...
And he can drink? Like, he can drink?
Yeah.
See that, everybody? Yeah, it's not bad to drink.
Yeah, it's good. It's good for writing too, you know?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
No, so we got together. I mean, there were many people come and go, but like we had Tiago de Mello. We had Tony Acosta from Luthier. Usually went there and
yeah, they were good friends.
Juan de la Mata.
Mm-hmm.
So Juanito de la Mata, we would go there and just We'd just play, and then guitarists would come, whoever was passing by.
What do you think of Tony? How do you get along with Tony?
Oh, great.
Okay.
Know, yeah.
Did you ever work there?
And no.
Oh, okay.
I didn't. Like, I, you know, we met, actually.
Is he a nice guy outside of the store?
Yes. He's
well, great. I just think it's funny how you walk in there and the lights are out. Just ridiculous. Yeah. It's like, turn the lights on, for Christ's sake. What's he doing?
I don't know.
You know, you walk in there, they don't turn on the... All the workers are working in the dark to save money.
I don't know.
That's my opinion.
Again,
let's get it straight. You're not saying that I am.
Yes.
I wish he would turn the lights on because it's weird.
Tony is a peculiar guy.
He is a peculiar guy, but
we all are in many ways.
One time I went in there and he... by the way, I like him and I get along with him. But one time I went in there and I this is when I was a student, and I had to get a pack of strings. So I got a pack of strings and I got, for whatever reason, I got hard tension. And I wanted normal tension.
I see.
So I walked right back inside with the strings in the bag, like just walked in. And, one of his girls, one of his daughters or whatever, I don't know, they seem to have some sort of relationship, says, no returns.
They wouldn't exchange it to you?
So I had to get Tony and he was like, yeah, okay. And I was like, what, buddy, like, come on. Like,
well.
Anyway, I don't want to talk the whole. Yeah. That's just,
well, he went there.
He's
and we
a sweet
play
guy,
and like,
he's a sweet guy.
And we have a great relationship.
Good.
it's just the way it is. Like, he actually.
He's running a business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. He does what he understands is
I'm
good
glad
for
he's
his
there
business.
Because if he wasn't there, there'd be no classical guitar stores.
And that's
no real
also true.
I mean, it's so nice to have one. It's so nice to have like a place where you can
source
just go
like
look at a score
of, yeah.
or something like that.
You know, I think in his defense, just he's been doing this business for a long time,
and it's
not you or me, but there's a lot of people that go there, and they just
buy a guitar and return it.
They just don't even go there to buy. They just have some time to kill, and they just sit down and start playing guitar and start browsing through everything, and then they go out and buy anything, and then he's.
Oh yeah, no. When I go in there, I know that I bring a $50 bill, and the whole thing goes.
I know. But I don't know why.
No,
but
well, there's not a lot of business. There's just not a lot of business in our line of work.
Yeah. Yeah,
unfortunately. I understand that.
Unfortunately,
yeah. But so it's so anyway. Back to Jorge Morel. But you would drink and play with him till 3 a.m. Where did he move?
He actually we were almost kind of responsible for him moving.
What did
I'm
you
sorry,
guys,
New York.
What did you guys do?
Well,
is he in Wisconsin?
No. He's in Orlando, Florida.
Okay.
He was getting very old. He has a lot of problems on his back and the hip. And
I mean, he's very old now, right?
Yeah. 86 now, maybe? Around there.
It's something like that. And the thing is, it's hard to be old in the city.
By himself. He was living by himself, So we were starting to get worried about him.
Right.
And so his daughter lived in Orlando, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And, we kind of talked to him into, maybe you don't want to be alone all the time by yourself, and you can just come back and visit. And, she moved down there, and he's, of course, he missed everything about New York. And
yeah, because he would go to the shows.
And the whole guitar scene, and people going to his house and playing for him.
No, he's
in Orlando, yes. It's not a lot going on for guitar in Orlando.
He can go to the Hard Rock Cafe.
Yeah, pretty much it. But he's with the daughter and the rest of the family from the mother's side. I mean, the wife's side.
Right.
And they treat him well. He's not alone. And it's important at this age not to be alone at his age.
Yeah.
So
What happened? I mean, was he married or?
Oh, he was married only once. And his wife... When the wife was 29 years old?
She was pretty young. Maybe
pretty young.
30s. No.
No, I don't remember if she passed in the 30s, but it may be,
I don't know. How
we don't remember. She was pregnant.
Oh.
And she... Was it a stroke or...
Something. Oh, it's awful.
It doesn't matter. Something
awful.
She dropped dead on the kitchen, pretty
much. Oh, my God, in her... Something like 30s, 40s.
Awful. Younger than that, 20s. Oh.
20s, so he 30s. Just never
and
recovered
he was just... So he lost the baby and the wife.
My God.
At the same time, and he, you know, he was always devastated by that. Like, to this point, when he talks about her, you know, he gets teary-eyed, you know.
Right.
He never got over that because he loved it. He loved her a lot.
Yeah.
You know, he really loved her. And most of his compositions are dedicated to her.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Everyone. Every time. You know.
So, but as far as you guys were instrumental in moving him to Florida. You guys were the push.
We were the beginning of the push. And then it got momentum. And then, you know, he really started considering. Because he considered before doing it.
Yeah, why not?
And he went down there and he was like, oh, you know. He still felt that he had a lot of him to be. That he could still be by himself. So he came back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at this point, he already needed someone to be with him, you know.
Now, when you did, you guys both met, you guys met when you guys were both studying with Ben.
Yes.
Vettery at Yale.
Yeah, that's correct.
How did this whole relationship happen? I mean, did you guys ever, I mean, how do you date another guitarist? Because I don't. I date someone in the TV industry. How has there ever been any issues?
You need to specify what subject.
That's true. Well, how long have you guys been married?
12 years.
Going 12 to... years. That's real. Okay, that's like a real.
Yeah, we just passed a 7 year each and every other each.
Yeah, 12 is being... 12. I'll give homage. Yeah, 12. I like.
Yeah, eight, it's a good number.
People have been the 6, 7, 8 thing. I'm a little bit like, well, we'll see.
No, we're the other side of the threshold.
The other side of the threshold.
So we met. She came. I was already finished with my. I was finishing. It was the first time she visited was 1998, and she was just. She came to the.
So US you're finishing masters then?
Yeah.
Okay.
She came to do. She was doing some camp work, you know, and.
Man, you look young. I mean.
I'm 39. We'll be 39.
Oh, you're 39. Soon. Okay, so I'm 37. Okay, so we're about the same. Yeah, okay.
So she had some time to spare, and then she had a friend, a flutist that was going to Yale at the time, and she came, can I just go and visit? And then she came, and she met Ben and play, and that's the first time I met her in 98.
But there's never been any, so you guys weren't doing competitions at the same time or anything like that?
No, we actually haven't. You know what?
Do you guys ever tell each other what to do?
All the time.
Well, you do? With music?
I don't know what to do. She knows what to do. She tells me, and then I'll follow. Not too well sometimes, but like she's a very good musician, so she's my toughest critic.
Because you guys have a duo together.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine, because husband and wife duos are great for whatever reason. I don't, you know, husband and wife, brother duos, you know, seem to be kind of the gold standard when it comes to duos. But I mean, I personally, I don't even see how
it's that simple. Relationship.
It would... Actually, the hardest thing is actually to find time to practice, believe me or not. Because we're both so busy, we both teach.
Yeah,
and when you come
that's
home,
true.
You just want to relax or do something else, and then you have to find time and energy to actually sit down and practice.
Right. See, that's a difficult. Yeah.
So
everything else is fine.
Well, that's the thing. I have a problem because my girlfriend has her little guitar. She's had it for, you know, 11 years. She is constantly asking me for lessons on it, and I'm like, not now.
Lessons are a different thing.
I know it is different. It is fun to collaborate. It's got to be kind of magical.
Oh, it is.
In all honesty.
You just need to schedule. And if you don't schedule, it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen, yeah. That's true. It's just schedule. Like, you know. Yeah, we were actually a little bit concerned at the beginning of a relationship with that. It's like, okay, how are we going to do it with these?
So like maybe we shouldn't.
What?
We play a couple pieces together.
Yeah. It started that way. So we were like, well, whatever repertoire you're playing, I won't play. Mm-hmm. And then vice versa. So, you know, she would be doing her entire set of things and I would do like complete different things. And then we had one or two duos here and there.
Right.
And then it wasn't official until like a year and a half ago.
Well,
2 years. In April, that we say, okay, you know what?
Wait, so your solo rep, you pick pieces that each other aren't playing?
Yes.
Like, that's smart.
Like she's playing.
She's playing Chaconne, so you're playing PFA. Yeah, all right.
She will do, I mean, I'm dying to play the Boccherini, the Omaggio Boccherini, Tedesco Sonata, but she's playing it. So, I'll wait until she gets tired of it, and then I'll play it.
But knock on, you done with it?
Yeah, almost, yeah. But I don't think she will ever be done with that. So that's a piece that is not going to be in my repertoire for a while, because she loves it, so... but it's okay. There are plenty of other pieces, you know. There are other fish in the sea.
Right.
So when, from the beginning, we agree on that.
Yeah.
And then it's been fine, you know. Just like we help each other, you know.
What do you think about your experience with Ben? What do you think you got out of him?
Ben is an unusual guy, you know. Depending of how you go there, with what tools you already come there, that it's beneficial to you. I mean, the amount of benefit that you get from him, you know. He's very musical, and he helps you like think outside the box. The Q1 Guitar School is very structured, and you know there are certain things that you know. And Ben was helping me look outside that box and say, no, go here. And he...
You're good at this.
Do this. Yeah, he made me do strings and just getting me all over the...
Did he ever make you do the breathing thing with the ball?
Oh, yeah. I was like hyperventilating.
He doesn't do that anymore, but he did it 10 years ago.
He doesn't do that anymore?
I don't think he does it as much.
I thought that was one of the best things I learned at Yale.
Just to breathe?
Yeah.
Oh, breathing.
Breathing when I was playing. Breathing. Because it was just like, you know, you don't need to realize
I wish that was the first. I mean, I tell my little kids, I'm like, just breathe.
Yeah, but
I'm like,
they
you
don't
understand how important it is. Like, you don't even need to take those beta blockers if you just breathe.
Yeah.
Just take a breath.
Just don't. I mean,
you're getting dizzy just because you're not
tense,
breathing.
And then you're getting all tense in the neck. And
breathing on stage is
I like remember him key. Holding the tube and I playing the Prelude from the fourth Lute Suite. And then by the fourth phrase, I was already like so high.
But at least you're not nervous.
Yeah, it wasn't.
You're high, but you're not nervous anymore.
You know what? When I did the
it's like a bomb.
Which
too.
Competition was it in? No, the competition in Allentown that I did the Allentown.
Yeah, I kind of. Yeah.
And I was actually during that was during the time that he was doing the whole breathing thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was with that thing breathing before. And I remember I played, it was Biela's Concerto. And I don't remember what was the solo. And I remember that David Lysner said to me, like, you were so calm. That was unnerving. He was like, because I think it was.
Your eyes were probably crossed.
I was just cruising through the piece. And he was like, it was just like. I was looking at you, and there was no hint of, like, you know, and it's true, I wasn't, like, at all.
So do you still do that, then? You take some breathing exercises
I do,
you
but
play?
No, but not with the whole thing, yeah. Not I don't go around with the apparatus, but I do actually breathe. And I made my students do breath mark in their music.
Mm-hmm.
So they learn how to...
Yeah. I do that,
breathe
too.
Even when they are playing.
But I don't mark it,
passage.
But I say you need to treat this like a breath mark.
If they
you
do
take
that,
a breath
like
if you have to.
You know, just because we are not playing a wind instrument, that we just don't necessarily correlate breathing into our playing, and then we forget about it. And then.
Yeah. And it has a negative effect on our phrasing, on everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd make them do the marking and then
big time.
Purposely breathe.
It's a great idea.
And it's just, it does work well. Plus, main thing is they keep him thinking of something else rather than being worried about what they are about to do.
At least you're scheduling the breathing time.
Yeah, like you're like, you know what you're heading at and what was coming.
Scheduling guitar dates with your wife
and
scheduling breathing time in your music. Two very big things.
Yeah.
Where were you before? So, well, I don't want to just say, I mean, is there anything else? I mean, you got to, because he does teach you how to think outside of the box. I mean, that's kind of the biggest
thing
that he does.
He was very big
because
about...
Because that's the way
he lives. He was a very big about colors, about contrast, about playing out, projecting, and just, you know, not being afraid of playing piano. And he helped me explore a lot of, like, different repertoire that I wouldn't necessarily do otherwise.
Like what?
You know, he was very big besides his compositions, which we did, you know.
Sure.
His etudes and, like, all
was he,
duos.
Was he, Was he big on that? Was he big on having you play his own compositions?
No, but like he will relate to that as a way of telling, okay, look, you know,
I know this. Yeah, exactly. Right. So we can start here.
We can start somewhere there.
That's interesting.
And he was big in not necessarily playing all traditional repertoire, but, you know, music that would be a little bit outside the box. Like Hansa, like, you know, just playing things that would be completely non-traditional in order to explore, you know, dynamic range and everything else.
Right.
Because you feel a little bit more of freedom when you play that repertoire.
Right.
Than when you play the traditional one, you know, because there are some things that you won't do in Bach, but, like, you know. And yet he made us do it. He would be like, no, I want you to do this completely. And then you understood that it's not necessarily that you would perform it that way all the time, but it's just to give you a different perspective. So sometimes when you came back to actually doing what you were intending to do in the first place, it's different because you have, you know, a certainty of what you want to do and why you want to do it this way. And so he was very big on that. He was, you know... he was very big in rhythm. He loved, you know, rhythm. And just, I remember, like...
Impulse,
yeah. He had this little hammer that had a whistle. You know, like a toy hammer with a whistle. And then he would just, like, bang your head with a whistle. Meanwhile, you were playing...
Who was your other teacher besides... I mean, so he was your math. Where'd you get your undergrad? I don't remember.
Cuba. I studied.
Let's talk about Cuba. You're born and raised in Cuba.
I came to the U.S. when I was 20 years old.
Right.
So I did all my education. And I started... I played.
Where in Cuba?
In Havana.
Oh.
Yeah, Havana. I grew up in a town called Cojima, where the old man of the sea, Hemingway, was the Hemingway based his story. And it's like 10 kilometers from Havana in bicycle.
Yeah.
I used to write all the time. And I started playing guitar when I was 10. There was a very, very good, great Cuban guitarist, actually, that lives in Barcelona, who happened to be my neighbor, like 3 blocks neighbor. And I would just go there and look at him practicing his left-handed, Alfredo Panebianco. Great, 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 great player.
Why his left hand?
He was left-handed.
Oh,
he played guitar
left-handed. So you would just watch his left hand, which is our right. Okay.
Yeah, so I would just watch him and just watch him. He would practice on the entrance of his house. And I would just go and stare at him. And he gave me the very first lessons and helped me play.
Yeah.
And then I got curious about reading and I started going to the conservatory.
Now, what's the conservatory there? Like I said, you're the first.
Well, in Cuba, generally, it's like a tracking education, you know, like the same they do for sports and everything else, in which, you know, you apply to a conservatory and you have a very specific curriculum that they work. You know, you still do math and science and all that, but the day will be divided into we'll either do mornings, the general classes, and then the afternoon was music classes or vice versa because they have
two shifts. And this is when you're a little boy?
Yeah. So I was just doing general, like regular middle school.
Yeah, it's like almost like a New York City system where there's vocational schools.
Exactly.
Which is not the way it is anywhere else.
Well, yeah. So I will go, I will do my middle school work on the morning and then the music classes on the afternoon. And
were you, was it hard? Were you poor?
Well, in Cuba, there's no one
it's
rich.
It's not
rich people. It's like what the revolution.
So how did you get a guitar?
What the revolution did?
Guitar?
Yeah, a state guitar. The revolution did is like it kind of disseminated kind of the middle class in Cuba. Mm-hmm. So it was the government and everybody else.
Yeah,
you know. So we had there were some guitars. Like Pablo Quintana Soto was a very good builder, Cuban builder, and he had to do like 60 guitars a year, just building guitars like.
They just had him at gunpoint building guitars.
Yeah, pretty, I think so. So, you know, out of like 60, he would get 5 to 10 guitars that were good, and the rest that were bad.
And they were like, why can't you make more? Yeah. And he's like, because I'm the loser. Trying to do a good job.
Yeah, so the rest of the guitars that were not the best, they will go to the schools and things like that, you know.
What was his name again?
Pablo Quintana Soto.
Quintana Soto.
Yeah, he lives now in Naples, Florida, or Fort Myers, Florida. He left Cuba,
yeah,
I think about 20 years ago too.
Oh, so he's gone now too.
He's gone too. So I don't know who's building now, but like, but
now they have always. How do you get out? How did you? I mean, is this okay to talk about? I don't know.
Yeah, I got out through through Mexico.
You go like I'm going on a vacation.
No.
I'll be back in a little bit.
In Cuba, there is no vacations. Like you go out only to work through with a government permit. So I was supposed to go to.
Then you're 20.
Yeah,
when this
I was going to the Tarrega competition, but I never made it.
Oh Jesus! I mean, God. So you know, people like I said, we can't even imagine.
Yeah.
This.
It's a little bit even more theatrical than that, but like let's just leave it at that. I made it to the U.S. I arrived in Miami June 9, 1995. It was a Friday.
How are you feeling at this point? I mean, are you nervous? Because you may never go home again. Do you ever go home?
No, I haven't.
So it's like this is a decision. I got to do this.
Yeah,
and you can't go back.
That's right. So I mean, at this point, maybe I could go back, but like, but even being an American citizen, I have to have the Cuban passport to go back into Cuba. Yeah. So I will enter Cuba as a Cuban citizen. When you enter, you know, and then anything can happen when you're in there. If they can keep you, and then the U.S. will be, what are you doing down there in the first place, you know?
Right.
So I have had my reserve about, like, going back.
Are your
back.
Parents still there?
No. My mother is in Miami. My parents divorced when I was very little, and they remarried. So my mother lives in Miami, and my father is in Toronto now. We got him out, like, 5 years ago already, 4 to 5 years ago.
Oh my goodness! So he. Was
I still
there.
Have.
So
family.
You hadn't really seen him for a decade.
Many. Yeah, for many longer than that. But jeez. Like, you know, so it's. It was a very tough decision. But happiness is never complete. I was young, and my father was like, "You gotta do this. If you don't do this now, you're gonna regret it."
Was it his? So it was always his dream to get out.
Oh, it's 90% of the Cuban people's dream to get out. So it's he just pushed me, and for me to like do it, it's like don't look back and just go and go.
Why do you think there's, you know, despite the fact that, like you said, 90% of the population wants to leave, what do you think it is that's making music come out of there that's so powerful?
I tell you what,
seems counterintuitive.
The only
unhappy people.
Yes and no. Actually, no. Unhappy people find ways to like
make themselves happy.
Make themselves happy. So music is escape out of their daily life and their situation.
Do you guys have access to
internet
music?
To music?
To all music?
No. Like Beatles was prohibited for many years in Cuba. Then my father would.
What about when you were a kid?
Were
you able to listen to Motley Crue?
No.
Guns N' Roses?
No. Nothing.
It's just not allowed?
No. Well, I mean, they will just censor music. Yeah. It's just, you know.
No, I don't think you. I don't care about Motley Crue or Guns N' Roses. I'm just saying,
I know. And they will censor all music, and then they just will only filter whatever they want. Like, of course, things got in.
Yeah.
But it was harder to get access to. So everything, and we had a lot of Cuban music, you know. So
that's gotta be part of it is that there is something about not being corrupted by capitalism and music.
True. Yeah.
There is
course.
Something to it. I'm not saying that justifies any of it.
No.
I'm saying that may explain why Buena Vista Social Club is who they are and country music is what it is.
Yeah,
which is but just it's just
it's just a little bit of everything. So you understand, in Cuba, if you don't make it, like most of the musicians that were studying with me, if they didn't make it, then they had no future. I mean, they would just only teach in a school, and so in order to be able to travel and see the world, you will have to go through the government. The government have to send you somewhere. It's not enough that you receive an invitation.
So you said
festival.
You were in, Tarrega competition.
Yeah. So
going to Spain through Mexico.
So if you are not good, if you are not practicing, if you are not on top of your craft, you know that when the opportunity comes, you won't be able to make it out. So it's an extra. So it's an extra intensive. Like when I entered Cuba at the university in Cuba, there were only 3 openings in guitar for like 350 guitarists that applied, you know. So, you know, you feel bad because you enter and, you know, like, I mean, I got lucky enough, I got through and got in. But there were at least 200 of them that I knew, and they were my friends, and I, you know. And you felt bad because you know that they had to do mandatory army draft.
Sure.
So if you don't get in, you go to the army. It's just like, you know what. So it was a
Well, how active is the army there?
Oh, very.
So they're constantly in skirmishes or whatever?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Who are they battling with? Just themselves?
Oh, but that's what Castro has done for this many years. It's right. It's just like keeping...
So there's constant military engagement.
Absolutely. Just, I mean, for something that is never going to happen or may happen, but like they're just keeping... They keep the country in Cuba like thinking that they are in constant danger of an aggression of some sort.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they just keep... That's how they justify the way the country is being run, like the poverty and, like, you know, everything else that's happening there. Oh, it's just like the embargo on this and that and that.
We're doing this to protect ourselves from terrorists.
The minute that the U.S. drops the embargo, like, you'd say, okay, we have free enterprise and commerce with Cuba. The government still will be in exact same situation.
Right.
Because it's the way internally, the U.S. unconsciously, by applying pressure, unconsciously has created a justification for them to just allow the country to be, like, you know, poorly fed. And, you know, so therefore, it's been since 1962 when Fidel did the Declaration of Havana as a socialist country.
Yeah.
It's been a constant, like, you know, threat. Oh, we are in this condition because the American government is creating an embargo and we don't have enough of this.
But you're also saying if the embargo goes away...
If the embargo goes away...
They'll find another way to...
Well, it will be harder to find another way.
It'll be harder because there will be money involved.
Yeah. But the country will still be... It would be a little bit better.
Right.
But it's still, the infrastructure is so disorganized and such a chaotic mess that I don't think it would be able to, you know, to change much. So they would be, okay, now what's your reasoning for us not being able to eat properly and, you know.
Right.
So it's just a big mess. And I don't know when it's going to be resolved.
What do they tell you about Americans down there? They just say, like, just... And I know there's propaganda here, for Christ's sake.
Oh, it's everywhere.
It's the entire world.
It's everywhere. Right. But
we're doing the same thing by justifying these wars and going to wars and saying we need these wars to protect ourselves. At the same time, we're, you know, investing in a military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
But so
throwing millions in that direction.
Right, millions just, in that direction.
Meanwhile, so we are like in
just as guilty.
Crisis.
That aside, what's like the propaganda?
Since fourth grade.
Right.
They were, at least in Cuba, they were teaching us Marxism and Leninism. Mm-hmm. So you have like classes that early in your age. So like I would say, I mean, in many ways, being brainwashed.
Yeah.
You know, and we understood what the capitalist system was all about and how bad it was and how, you know, they make profit out of like education and health and like the commonwealth of the people and blah, 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 blah. But Cuban people knew better than that because we were under capitalist influence until 1959, from 1901 to 1959. Yeah. So the old generation used to say, well, don't get fooled by that. This is just not true.
Yeah.
But, you know, because it's not like in Russia that they went from being a feudal country to being a socialist country. In Cuba, we had actually capitalism before for many years. So, you know, it was not as... the people, the government may say what they want, but the people understood that it was just government and government. This is not the American people. Right. It's not like, you know, the way the American people think, the way the government think. It's never a direct relation.
And we don't equate ourselves with our government.
Exactly. And the same token, they always like, and you see when Americans go, because they do go to Cuba, they go through Mexico, through Canada, and they fly there. And then when they go there, they're surprised at like how open and how friendly the people are.
How
like
nice
the
whole, it is. Yeah.
And the Cuban people happen to be very fun, you know. They like sharing the little that they have, and they are not afraid to you know, to welcome people and, you know.
What a shame that that culture, that we're being deprived
It's going back and forth, right. You know, because the Cuban people are heavily deprived of everything else that
if Cuba opened up, that would be like my first vacation.
Oh, you would like it.
I would go directly there just because of all the stuff that comes out of there, all the music.
So going
all of our connection as guitarists with it.
Going back to the music, it's just that was our way of escaping, of any chance of getting out of that country and experience other cultures.
Is that how Leo Brower did it? Did he get out through music?
Yeah, well, when he...
Barueco probably then too?
Barueco escaped Cuba, just like...
Just like ran.
Yeah, then just like, you know, pretty much...
I'm fucking out of here.
Yeah, absolutely. And and Leo was... He came to Hartford right after the revolution, shortly after the revolution.
Yeah, because he's from that
and they, generation. You know, they... Excuse me. They just use him... At some point, depending on how good of an artist you are, there's the government can only refrain you so little. Then they cannot just keep you in. You know? But they use you instead then as a flag to show how good the system is, and so they use Brower as that as well. You know, and being a great composer as he is, he just traveled the world and visited everywhere, and he never wanted to leave Cuba. But why would he? Like, I wouldn't want to leave Cuba if I would have the choice of just traveling anywhere.
Yeah.
If I could, you know, just come the summer to New York and play a concert.
Yeah.
That doesn't have to be approved and filtered by the government.
He never left.
He
never left.
But he just would be working when he was in Cordoba directing the
orchestra. But like you're saying, he's from the generation where it was a crossover where the government was still trying to appease people his age. So he's part of that old... idea that Cuba, like the part of the original revolution.
They actually, many of them did believe. Like,
yeah, right, that's what I'm saying.
They were actually...
Like, this isn't deeply, so bad.
Right now, no, actually, it's even better than not so bad. They deeply believed because the country, Batista, was so corrupt that, you know, anything that would have come after him, it would have been supported by the mass.
Yeah.
It's like the grade of support that the Cuban Revolution had was 95-96% of the population were in favor, including the middle class, the Cuban middle class, until they start losing property because they start doing. I forgot now the name of the law that he just start confiscating all private property and make it
public.
Public, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Made it state. State-owned properties. So, you know, sugar plantations, houses, businesses, anything, you know. There was no public enterprise on the socialist system.
So you so you're happy now, though, in Wisconsin?
Oh, I think...
I don't know if I would rather live...
Yeah, listen, it's freezing in Wisconsin, but let me tell you something. I've been already quite around the world playing, and there's no country...
Okay.
In the entire world that will allow you to feed and become one of their own like the United States.
Oh, really?
Nowhere else.
Oh, so you can't just go...
Like if I go to Spain.
France.
Spain. France, I will always be a foreigner. Even if my grandfather is like a Spaniard.
Right.
And I will always be a foreigner. One thing is to go and visit and all be pretty. Another one is to stay there and live. Then they feel like you're trying to take their...
Yeah.
Bread, you know.
Yeah.
So in this country we have, although the American dream is still getting, you know, a little bit obscure. It's not as direct as what it was to have a career, a car, a house, a property, blah blah blah. That all still there, but it's not as clear anymore. The path of what is to to be
the path to that. You have to be more creative.
Yeah, more creative, pretty much. But it's the only country that I actually, you know, I'm Cuban and people don't mind, you know, that I'm Cuban. And I'm just part of that big melting pot because everybody here came from somewhere else. And that's what makes that.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad that you're having that experience. I don't know if everybody's having that experience.
But. Well, it's not roses for everyone. And it was not roses for me either. I worked really hard to get what I'm
at. You sure did.
And not just on guitar only.
No.
when I came to the U.S., I was just working in a warehouse, you know.
No, like you're like saying, the language barrier. Wait, the workhouse? What do you mean? You were working in a workhouse?
Like
a warehouse. Computer
in a warehouse.
Yeah, like yeah. just, yeah, shelving and stuff or whatever.
Yeah, it was a computer company, you know.
Yeah.
And I worked in there for a long time and just like, and I used to tell the people that worked there, like the few Cubans that were there, like, oh, I just, you know, I'm a guitarist and I would like to, and they were like, you're going to die here, you know, you're going to maybe go a little bit up on the scale here in this company, but that would be it. And at some point, Carlos Rafael Rivera was the one that helped me. Actually, he was going to audition to Yale University and USC and Juilliard, I think he auditioned too. And he told me, just come with me, you know. And I, you know, sold the card, like got a plane ticket and went to Yale.
Right.
Audition. And just Carlos ended up going to USC. And I just received the letter for admission to Yale. And then, like, I said, okay.
Something about going to Yale.
It's like, it's a choice, you know. Yeah. Like, Ben was actually very grateful about that, too. You know, I told him, I haven't really played guitar much. And, I mean, I borrowed this guitar to come to audition here. And this is it. I don't have a lot to offer right now. And I played the first movement of the Black, the Camaro, and then he told me, okay, so what do you need? And then he helped me in that at all. You know, he just gave me a boat of confidence. He saw something. It's like, well, he has talent. He just had to go back into playing. And he let me in.
Yeah, because, I mean, when you were 20, you had other things to do than play.
Well, yeah.
You were busy.
Well, carrying boxes mainly.
Right. So then you just like, by the time you're 22 or whatever, you're up there.
Yeah.
Just like warp speed. You got to get back in the game.
Exactly. It was brutal. It was brutal getting back. But, you know, I made it. And I was determined because I knew the alternative was not.
Yeah.
not negotiable.
Well, look at you now, man. All set.
You could say that. You know, nothing is set in stone in this country.
Yeah,
everything
that's the
is
problem.
In constant motion. But we are happy where we are at.
Yeah,
our department is actually very strong now. It's like we're getting great players out of there. And
I'll bet. And
the best thing, why am I in Wisconsin? Is because they offer me the possibility to create my own concept of what a bachelor's and a master's. Guitar degree should entails, you know, what classes should be taken. So I did a whole mixture of classes that I thought from Cuba that were very good, classes from the Paris Conservatoire that were very good, classes from Yale that were very good, and then I mix all these concepts and I have a very good curriculum going on now. So
yeah, they couldn't ask for more.
All of the kids are very
happy.
Now
you do not have a doctorate.
They don't have the platform for a doctoral. They don't.
I'm saying but you don't have one.
I don't. No.
Good.
I don't.
That's what I think.
It's just. I mean,
How much do we need? It's ridiculous.
It was offered to me to do a doctoral, but I said, like, what am I going to do? Just write papers?
I want to start playing. I want to start making a life for myself.
Yeah. It's.
It's not necessary.
Unfortunately, if you want to. Teaching an institution, they make you believe that it is necessary and you have to.
I don't believe it.
But not everywhere. You know, from all 50 states, how many guitar programs we have? Just a very few. There are many universities all around in the big...
No, get out there, start making some albums, start commissioning some works, get to work.
Yeah. I agree. You know? Some people just shelf on the doctorals as well because they... waiting for the possibility of actually
getting... I think that's
getting...
really what it is. It's first of all, you know, you're in a comfortable environment that fosters you as a performer.
Yeah.
Fosters you as a competitor too. But, you know, I don't want to get too, you know, much into it. And also, I got to get out of here. So where are you going to spend Christmas then? Back in Wisconsin? You guys going back? What were you guys doing in New York?
New York, we came... I played a concert in Carnegie Hall on Thursday.
Why didn't I? Thursday. What the hell's the matter with me? Why didn't I... What was I that sort part of? Is that part of the festival?
No.
How was that? Why didn't I go to that?
I don't know. Where were you?
We don't know. Yeah, we both forgot this stuff.
I'll tell you this.
Why don't I know about that? Whose response? Is this New York Classical Guitar Society? No way.
No.
Carnegie Hall is its own.
Okay. The story is I contacted Dario and told them I want to play in Carnegie.
Oh, it's D'Dario, right?
No. It wasn't D'Dario.
Okay.
they were like, well, we have the Lord Jones players, like, you know, we we'll want to schedule, but it will take time and we don't know.
Yeah, I got the and same said, thing for, yeah.
And I said, okay, you know what? I rented the hall. I said, I don't need anybody. Like, if they do it, I can do it.
So you just called Carnegie Hall directly.
We played a series of concerts, raised funds for that, and we rented the, rented the space.
Okay.
The Carnegie Hall.
Now you got your Carnegie Hall under your belt.
I already played there before in 98. I did a concert, like, in, it was American Composer Forum, whatever it was. And, you know. But I wanted to play a solo recital. I mean, a recital there.
Right.
You know, like half a recital with somebody else.
No, that's not the same. Yeah.
So I just like, okay, so how much it is? It's $8,000. Okay.
Yeah, that's how much it is.
So fine. All right. Put the things together and start working on it. And I got it.
Well, congratulations. How did it go?
How did it go?
It went very well.
It went good. I was happy with it. I mean,
I wish I could. I would have totally gone and seen that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's
well, congratulations. And happy holidays.
Yeah, same to you.
Merry Christmas. I hope you enjoyed. Was it okay?
Oh, it was great. It was great.
All right. Okay, so we'll have this up at some point. Thanks so much for joining me, Renee.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
There you go. Thanks.
To all of you out there.
All of you. All six of you.
Yeah.
Alright guys, this is Whirler of the Dance, the third movement, entitled Dance by Carlos Rafael Rivera. This is Renee performing it. So I'm just going to leave you guys to it. It's one of my favorite pieces.